Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking ditching work you hate and landing the job you want with Ashley Stahl.
Today on the show, we are talking with career expert Ashley Stahl. And since we're talking about jobs, Ashley has quite the impressive resume. She interned with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Governator. She pursued a career in counterterrorism while getting her master's degree in war studies in London. And then she worked for the Pentagon running an award-winning program. But then, you know, even with all that success, Ashley still felt a degree of uncertainty until she finally changed her career path. Ashley is now a career coach, where she empowers people to discover their authentic careers, land more job offers, and then launch their dream businesses as well. So Ashley, we're excited to talk to you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Ashley, we're excited too. Glad to have you on the show. And yeah, the first question that we ask anybody who comes on How to Money is, well, Matt and I, we drink a beer on every episode because we like beer and we're willing to spend a good bit of money on tasty, delicious craft beer, even though some people might say that's crazy or that's too much. So do you have something like that in your life that you're willing to splurge on in the here and now, even while you're trying to save and invest and be thoughtful about your future?
Yes, I love to spend on skincare. Just the other day, I got a facial and she was like, what are we going for today? And I'm like, I want to look like my skin is 10 years old. So, you know, nice. I'm 34 and I'm drinking that Fountain of Youth vibe right now. And I
that
just
should
think
also
that
be the name of a beer.
Yeah, Fountain of Youth. Well, and you know what? I think that feeling good about yourself, you know, obviously comes from the inside, but it really helps when you feel good on the outside too.
When you know you've taken all the steps, all the reasonable steps you can on the outside, I would say both Joel and both of our wives are pretty into that as well. They, I don't know, I feel like they, every other week, they're kind of researching the next thing that their friends are talking about, whether that's oils or different serums.
My wife does it on like the cheapest. She has these masks that she and my daughters will use sometimes. They'll put on their face and they're like kind of crazy alien-like colors.
Oh, yeah.
But apparently it works, so.
Yeah, the more alien you look, the more it's working.
I love that. Ashley, you know, before we talk about finding the work you love, I'm interested in hearing a little about your own personal finance journey. What did you learn about money growing up? What was your money story and how has that impacted your view towards money now as an adult?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has a money story, right? I think we come into the world and our thermostats and our mindset is kind of set by our parents about what's possible with money, how easy or hard it can be, how available it is. I think in my case, I had an entrepreneurial dad who dropped out of college, created a financial firm, and really had a lot of success until later, when I was around 5, 6, he had to make the really hard choice to close his company. The market changed, and he had 300 employees and a huge office space and nearly had to claim bankruptcy. And during that time, I'll never forget, around my 10th birthday, and I write about this in my book, he got me luggage, which most of my birthdays he had gotten me really fancy things. Like one time he got a train that went around the entire house that I could ride.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really extra gifts. And this particular year it was luggage. And I remember seeing the outside of the box when I was 10 and thinking to myself, there must be something else in the box. It's not luggage. And when it was, I was just being a spoiled kid and I had a meltdown. And I'll never forget it because it was the first time I realized what money was. It was the first time I realized that when you don't have it, what you can have changes. And I guess that's a very privileged reality that I didn't really know what money was until I was 10 because there was so much of it. But when he lost it and we had to move and let go of our home, I ended up liking the fact that we had a smaller home because I remember thinking, oh, he's closer to my bedroom. You know, my parents are closer to me, which is funny to see how kids think about money and their home versus parents who are kind of stuck in the more, more, more focus. So yeah, that was kind of my first experience of money, was realizing that my dad lost it, realizing that presence would change from it. And that day my dad ended up having a panic attack because I had such a horrible tantrum over this gift. And I went to his bedroom and he was not only crying, but he was struggling to breathe a little bit. And here I am, 10 years old. And I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah, this is just going to kill me. And I said, what's going to kill you, Dad? And he said, money. Mm. And from that moment on, I had a lot of competing beliefs about money. And I think a lot of people who are listening now, I would hope that they would look back in time, like, what is the moment that you realized what money was? And ask yourself, what were you making? What beliefs were you making in your head about the person you were talking to or listening to? Yourself, money, the world. What did it mean for you? For me, it meant nothing's fun without money anymore. And I'm in charge of saving everyone because I don't want my dad to die. So money can kill you. So it was a lot of like, I need it, but it might kill me if I go get it. And so you can kind of see that show up in my adult life. I'm a high achiever. I am an entrepreneur. And obviously, there was quite a pivot leaving counterterrorism and starting a career coaching business. But in that pivot, starting online courses, I worked really hard to get a course on how to get a job out into the world. And after years and debt, I ended up thriving and getting thousands of customers in just a couple of months from a webinar that I had made. And overnight, I went from negative $100K to, you know, around $4 million in revenue. Wow. And it was like my brain wasn't equipped to hold that kind of success because I had so much fear from my childhood of losing money. And I sabotaged my business. Right when I saw all the money coming in, I hired a bunch of lawyers and said, can you make sure that I'm making this right and that I'm in integrity and I'm following all the rules? There's a lot of rules online. And I turned off my entire business because they told me they needed a month to look through all my materials. And when I turned my advertising back on, it wasn't converting the same. And I had a ton of overhead. I had a team to pay for. I had employees. And the numbers just weren't adding up. So I ended up going into debt just like my dad had. And I spent a lot of years in my late 20s paying off that debt. And now, you know, I'm speaking on stages about success, about resilience. You know, when I lost all my money, my sister also passed away. It was a lot that happened. Wow. And I'm really committed to helping people see where their blind spots are when it comes to money, because that first step of having awareness is so important.
Yeah, and it can be tough as an individual, one, to go back and look through your past and figure out what are those, you know, defining moments that impact your everyday thinking about money. And sometimes it's emotionally difficult to process those things, but it's so crucial so that we can prevent making those same mistakes again, right? Like, so that we can avoid history repeating itself. I want to ask you, like, you mentioned that pivot actually from counterterrorism, that you worked in before you started your own business as a career coach. I really enjoyed kind of reading about your first career there in your book. But like, what made you choose that career path initially? And then why did you choose to, you know, leave behind a successful career in search of kind of starting your own thing?
Yeah, I mean, you mean that counterterrorism to career coach isn't an obvious career pivot?
Yeah, everybody's doing it.
Just the classic progression.
Obviously, I came out of the womb and I was like, I'm meant to be a career expert. I grew up in a house where the news was always on. My dad was really into politics, and sometimes he even still gets on his soapbox, and I feel like, vote for you, Al, because he's so political. And so it was really natural for me to have an interest in that because I was surrounded by it. I had uncles on the opposite side of the political aisle from my dad. So there was fighting at the Sunday night dinner table, and my mom was always trying to, you know, make them quiet down. And I also had a ton of family on the East Coast during 9/11. So I was really impacted by the fear that I saw in my parents' faces that day. And, you know, I think a lot of people who are millennials, especially, they remember where they were standing when they got that news. And so I remember thinking to myself, like, I can fix this. I can help with this. And I was interested in politics. We were always talking about it. So when I got to college, I went to the career services office and I didn't know what to major in, but I knew I was interested in politics. And what I didn't realize at the time is that, and now as a career expert, I could tell anyone, there's a big difference between what you're interested in and what you're naturally talented at. And they don't always reconcile. And your natural skills are so much more important for your career than your interests. That's why a lot of my message in my book, in my talks online, is all about not following your passion, even though your passion matters. So I wasn't really privy to this yet. I go to the career services office. And I told the woman, you know, I don't know what to major in. And she gave me all those three-worded tirades we all hear. You know, follow your passion. Do what you love. And I remember thinking to myself, like, well, you know, I'm passionate about cupcakes and, you know, spa treatments, but I don't think I'm a good masseuse and I don't think I'm a good baker. And, you know, in retrospect, being a good consumer of something doesn't mean you're a good producer of that thing. And I think that's the disconnect, especially with the millennial generation and even Gen Z, you know, especially when you look at Generation X, like, you know, they were taught to respect ranking order, stay in a company, lock in and grow. Whereas the millennial generation, we're job hopping. And I think a lot of that is not only because of the recession, which really influenced our options and the pain of a lot of debt, but also, you know, it made people jump around a lot because they were trying to find themselves based on this awful advice of following your passion. So I left the career services office more confused than ever, and I majored in three things because I was indecisive, and I picked politics, history, and French because foreign languages always came easy to me. And yeah, I did everything from that point on. There was something about having a plan that felt so good to me, and I just wanted to be the next, you know, what was her name in Zero Dark Thirty? You know, that actress. And
the smart lady.
The smart lady in Zero Dark Thirty. I wanted to be her. And so I just gave everything. But what I was missing was, you know, there's two dynamics in any career path. The first one is the what, meaning what you do, what your skills are. That's how you use your mind, your body, and your heart all day long. So that matters a lot. The second is the how. That has to do with your core values, your energy, your priorities. Given that 50% of people leave their job because they don't like their boss, what we can assume to be true from that is that how your job looks matters just as much as what your job is. So for me, I went to grad school and I had these moments where I was like, wow, I am way too sensitive to be working in national security. What am I doing here? But I let my interest override my core nature. The fact that I was a sensitive, soft-hearted woman who wasn't really meant to be in a world where there's a lot of death, there's a lot of vigilance, there's a lot of fear. Either way, I kind of silenced those voices. And, you know, like many of us, we hear about very limited careers as a kid. We hear about being an astronaut or a teacher or a lawyer. We don't hear about, you know, all these other options. So I just followed it. I went to the best school I could in London. I went to King's College London and the Department of War. I studied security. I became fluent in French and I started learning Arabic. And then I graduated and couldn't get a job in the middle of the recession, slept on my parents' couch for a few months too long, and ended up taking what I could get. And that got me to an ad agency making minimum wage. And I was taking Arabic classes at UCLA at night. And then one day it struck me because I just felt such a hopelessness, because it's one thing not to like your job. It's a whole other thing to not know where you want to go next. That's like a hopelessness and a pain that I wish for no one. And I think it really is why I'm in this business, because I know what that feels like. And so I just contacted my university and said, do you have a list of people who have graduated and moved to Washington, D.C.? And the Department of Government ended up sending me 2,000 names and emails. And I ended up emailing and calling all 2,000 people over 4 to 6 months. And after I started getting kind of a conversion rate, like, you know, falling on my face, saying the wrong thing, starting to get people to respond, I ended up feeling confident to quit my job and move to DC. And 6 weeks later, I had 3 job offers and I landed my position at the Pentagon. But what's so interesting about this is that along my way into the government, I discovered how much I loved job hunting. And it was so needed. So many people were underemployed during the recession. And they would come to me and say, how'd you get such a cool job? I tripled my salary, which, I mean, when you're making minimum wage, isn't the most impossible thing. But I was so proud to almost be making 6 figures. I was, you know, in my early 20s. And I got a management opportunity for a defense contractor at the Pentagon. So I was just really grateful. And then on the weekends, I started helping people land job offers. Friends would ask me to redo their resume. And they would all say, you should be a career coach. And I just remember thinking, like, what does that even mean? Like, what is a career coach? Do they, like, cheer on the sidelines of your career like a hockey coach? You know?
Yeah, it's like, how do you even do that?
Yeah. And what kind of career do I even have to coach off of? Like, I was in my early 20s. So I just stuck to what I knew, which was how to talk to people and how to get job offers, because I got so many job offers. And that was what eventually got me into having a podcast, creating online courses, and now writing a book about how to find your purpose in the workforce.
Exactly. Well, actually, we're going to dive into so much of that. We're going to talk about finding the right career. We're going to talk about how it is that you were able to network so well and to get all those job offers. But, you know, like, there are a lot of folks who are thinking about quitting their job right now. There's some stats out there that show that 4 in 10 folks are strongly considering something completely new. You said that an even larger percentage of folks are actually just casually job hunting on the reg. So what would you say to our listeners who are among that number and they're wanting to pursue something new?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the pandemic has had a lot of research. We've seen 9 out of 10 in some surveys, people are saying in the workforce that they're burnt out.
Wow.
So even if you love what you do, if you're burnt out, that's a quick recipe to not love what you do. You know, I love shopping, but I don't want to shop at 1 in the morning, you know? So it's like everybody has boundaries with their relationship with what they love.
Exactly.
I would say if you are feeling disconnected in your work, the first order of business is just to reconnect to yourself, because a lot of people say that they need clarity when in reality, they just need to connect to themselves. And what that really means is, first of all, stop listening to the noise. We've heard so much noise. We've been so domesticated since we were little kids, told what paths are there for us. We are so afraid to not survive in the world. You know, there's typical gender roles that very much so still exist. You know, you have a lot of men, especially, who are feeling pressure to provide. You have women who are feeling pressure to get a certain place before they have kids. And more than ever, that pressure is making us exhausted and disconnected. So I would say, anybody listening right now, first order of business, connect to yourself. Come up with a list of people, of places, of things that make you feel yourself. And I have a lot of girlfriends that I love, but there's a couple in particular where after I talk to them, I just feel myself again. There's things I love to do. I love dance classes. I love putting my feet in the ocean. It's so grounding for me. And when I make space for those things, I feel more me. And when I feel good, it feels good to feel good. I start noticing in my body what's a yes and what's a no. Because, I mean, let's face it, we have 200 million neurons in our gut. Approximately, that's the size of a catter dog's brain. It's no wonder that scientists are now calling our gut our second brain, because there's an intelligence to when your stomach sinks or when you get butterflies. And so I think people need to first connect to themselves so they can start to feel those feelings, because your body's constantly giving you feedback. You're feeling breadcrumbs, you're feeling nudges, you're feeling contractions, you're feeling no's inside of your body. And I think we've just cut off from that because we're so burnt out. And when you're burnt out enough, you're literally working from a different brain. There's so many studies that show that your brain looks different on a scan. And that's why everything feels harder, because it actually is.
And one of the things that you mentioned in the book too is thinking about, like, what lit you up as a child, like what, and so why is that so important, that one of the keys to fulfilling work is thinking about what you gravitated towards when you were younger?
I mean, when you're a kid, you're not thinking too much, you know, you're just in connection, you're just in curiosity. We learn to be afraid. We learn to look both ways when we cross the street. We learn not to touch the stove when it's hot. And so I think what's so beautiful about looking at who you were as a kid is noticing where you felt a sense of expansion, where you naturally went towards. Communication was always a knack for me. Even if I go, you know, not totally back as far as being a little kid, but my first job when I was 16, I worked at a preschool over the summer, and I was helping the chef prepare meals for all the little kids at lunchtime. And I noticed typos in the flyers at the school all the time. And so I used to go up to the front desk and say, hey, there's a typo. Hey, this is a run-on sentence. And eventually they started to call me their eagle eye. And the thing is that who you are what your gifts are, it always wins, and it was always shining through. And so for me, I've always had a gift with words, and it makes sense now that I'm a speaker and an author and all of these different things that mean so much to me. I'm being who I am, and it's such a beautiful feeling, and what I wish for anyone, to get paid for being you. Like, you don't need to be anybody else. And so many people feel so much shame, you know, for not being good at, you know, whatever it is, spreadsheets or whatever their job is making them do. And the reality is, like, celebrate what you're not good at. Use it as feedback. And so this awareness for me of having a foundational core skill set with words has been something I've carried with me throughout my career. And that's why in my book, I talk about 10 different core skill sets that I believe exist in the workforce, words being one of them. And my argument in the is really just about focusing in on what is your number one core skill set? How has it shown up in your life? And if you're struggling to know what that is, you know, ask people in your life, when have you seen me at my best? When have you seen me at my best? You know, colleagues, parents, friends, and notice what people say to you. What skill are you using? Because that, to me, is the key to a fulfilling career, is using a skill that is a gift for you. And the research backs that it feels good to be good at something. So there's just more happiness when you're doing something you're good at and natural at.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's just a great way of putting it. And Ashley, yeah, this has been great hearing basically how you were able to find your career, what basically lit you up. And we're going to talk more about career and finding that job specifically, and how it is that our listeners, how they can find the careers that feel authentic to them. So we'll get to all that right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking with Ashley Stahl about, you know, ditching a job that you hate, landing the job that you want. Ashley, some people are thinking as they're listening to this, one, you know, throughout COVID, man, I'm not just in a job that I hate, I'm in a career that I hate. Like, I don't want to do this at all anymore. They're considering leaving the comfort of an industry that they're familiar with. They've been working in like a decade or longer for something entirely new. So like, what questions would you ask that person? How would you probe them to make sure that they're leaving for the right reasons? If someone's looking to make a shift that big, how do they do it?
Yeah, I have a lot of different thoughts on this. I mean, the first thing is that people mistakenly buy into the belief that they need to quote unquote start over. But the truth of the matter is that your skills that you've used in the past have relevance for where you're going in the future. And it's just incredibly important that you are able to communicate about those. You're able to find that thread. So let's say you've been working in technology and you want to pivot into communications. You want to look at your jobs in the past like a pie chart and all many different slices of different things you're doing. You want to tune into the slice that has some sort of crossover with communications. Maybe you wrote manuals. Maybe you helped advise the marketing team on the product you created. Whatever it is, you want to tune into what that is so that when you have interviews or when you start networking or when you rewrite your resume, you are clear on what it is that you need to do or say that really clarifies and makes sense of why you're going the direction you're going. And as I talked about before, you know, you have the what of your career, meaning what skill you're using. That's what you carry with you throughout the course of your career. You know, people always ask me, should I stay or should I go? And I always tell them, you know, if you are honing and growing your core skill set in your job, you're golden. You're building something that you want to take with you throughout your work. The thing that people get confused on is more about the how of their career, meaning how they work. So, you know, right now we're seeing record numbers. More people are quitting their jobs than we've ever seen in two decades. And yet the rate of joblessness, like the length of time that people are spending jobless, is very long, unusually long, which just tells me that people need to make sure they have a job in their hand before they leave their current job. But that being said, it's like, really understanding that people are leaving because they want to work on their terms. And it's so important to really understand yourself. How do you want to work? What do you value? If you value family or balance, what do those mean to you? You know, I think it goes in people's love life too. People look for someone with the same core values as them, but they don't actually define their values. Like, I had a client who told me adventure was his core value. And when I asked him what that meant, he told me it was skydiving and adrenaline seeking things. I had another client, she told me the same thing, adventure is a core value. And when I said, well, what does that mean? You know, she lived in Miami. She said to me, oh, it's trying new restaurants. And I was like, all right.
Awesome. Different senses of adventure there.
Exactly. So, I mean, I guess choose your adventure in this life, but define your adventure too. And so the thing about your career is that a lot of people right now are not realizing that the reason they want to leave their job is not because of the job itself, the responsibilities they're doing. It's because of their boss, the culture, the people, the work environment. And so if that's the case, you need to know that, because sometimes you're not meant to be making a career pivot. You're meant to be going to a different company. And it seems obvious, but it's not. And a lot of people get stuck in that. So that's the first step. Is it the skill set I'm using, or is it the place that I am and how it's feeling for me? You know, another thing with core values is people are notoriously not great at defining them. So after I talk about the 10 different core skill sets I think exist in the workforce, which obviously I can't obscure humanity into 10 core skill sets, but largely I think that this is where people tend to fit in. I talk about core values, and the mistake people make when they try and figure out their values is they pick words that are aspirational. You know, like I had a client who was a really awesome, but also kind of high-strung lawyer. And she told me, she'd always tell me I'm so high-strung. And when we picked her core values, she chose the word peace. And I remember laughing on the phone, and I was like, that feels like an aspiration, not a core value. And so it's so important that people are really honest with themselves of like, what are those top five words that are non-negotiable principles by which I live my life? You know, in my case, self-expression is a core value. Anybody who's listened to me on my podcast or read my book, they're going to hear so much self-expression. Another one is freedom. And you're going to see that show up in my day-to-day life. I'm very free with my plans. I like to go travel whenever I want. You know, it's just the key ingredients to who you are. So I think those two pieces of skill and values are so important to know before you start tuning into your career pivot.
Totally. Yeah. And when it comes to those core skills, Ashley, you know, I loved what you said there too about it's not starting over, and yeah, how oftentimes we're building things that we will kind of change the shape of slightly. It's like a piece of clay, and it's like, well, you know, it used to be a vase, but now it's a cup. You're not changing it, you know, transforming it into something completely different.
You don't have to dash it into pieces on the ground. Yeah, you can like reform
it. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that like it's often true with our money as well, because we talk about being smart with your money and making those wise moves and investing for the future, even when you don't necessarily know what it is that you're pursuing. But having that there gives you options down the road. You know that at some point you're going to have a change of taste. You're going to have a change of plans. You might even have overarching goals that are also going to shift. And I think the same can be true when it comes to some of these different skills. Continue building, but be open to the, you know, the idea that, well, it might look slightly different from now, but just know that you're not starting from scratch. I think I just wanted to point that out too for our listeners, because oftentimes we don't know exactly what we want to do with our money, but it still makes sense to kind of make those smart moves all along.
Yeah, and that thought of starting over completely can be kind of demoralizing.
Yeah, it's a story people tell themselves in their head, and there's no such thing. You know, first of all, if you ask any futurist who's really impacting the future of the workforce with their research, the number one thing you're going to hear is that soft skills matter right now to them, mm-hmm, to companies more than hard skills, because we've got a certain percent of the workforce that will be replaced by robots. And so what that tells me is that who you are, how you navigate conflict, you know, how you work with other people, how you work remotely, these things matter even more than you might realize. So I think the mistake people make is not realizing that the problem is not your past or your pivot. It's how you talk about it, because there's what you're saying and then there's the energy it's riding on. And so if you go into an interview and you share the skills that you've used that are super relevant and super impactful, that's the TV station the person listening to you is tuned into with you.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're making excuses, not so much.
Yeah. I think actually like tools can be so helpful in helping us kind of figure out what we're good at. Like sometimes I need a quiz or like to help me. And you mentioned asking someone who knows you well. Like if I'm taking a quiz sometimes, like a personality test, I have to ask my wife all these questions. Well, what am I like in this? Because it's hard for me to pinpoint it because, but she has this like clear view of who I am that maybe I get muddled sometimes. But I speaking of that, like you have a career quiz on your site that I took and I'm an intrapreneur according to the test results. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be, especially as you described it, one, it was a term I'd never really experienced before, and it was so incredibly accurate as I combed through the material that you sent my way, and it told me a lot about how I work effectively, and it just made me like thankful for the work position I'm in right now because like Matt basically takes care of all the stuff I don't care about. Like I have all these big ideas, but I need some of that insulation from just being a complete full-on entrepreneur. But yeah, like can you tell folks like how a tool like that can be helpful, why you have that quiz on your site and what that can do for people?
Yeah, I love that you took the quiz. That's so much fun. And it's so the idea behind the quiz is to help people start tuning into this argument that I have that it's all about your core skill set, because after the past 10 years of coaching hundreds of people one-on-one and then thousands online, this is where the sauce is. This is where people are missing the mark. So I was excited to be able to ask questions about how somebody is gifted and be able to tell them what their gift truly is. The thing about quizzes is I hate to put people in boxes and tell them that's who they are, because the truth of the matter is people are malleable and we change and everybody's allowed to change. But I do like to get to the core of who someone is. And that's why even in my book, you see the word core all the time. I talk about people's core nature, core skill set. And the intrapreneur actually falls under one of my 10 core skill sets. So I said that words was my core skill set, but innovation is one of the core skill sets I talk about. And that is for the intrapreneur or the entrepreneur. And you understand usually which one you are if you're the creative self-starter, the problem solver, the visionary. But the difference between the entrepreneur and the intrapreneur is the entrepreneur needs all-out freedom. They need creative freedom to work on their ideas. They need time freedom to work on their terms. Versus the intrapreneur doesn't necessarily always need to be working on their idea. They need autonomy to execute. And they also have a different relationship with financial risk. They tend to have a different relationship than the entrepreneur with flexibility versus freedom. They tend to just need flexibility, not all-out freedom. And so the world needs both of them. And it's so painful when I watch people being someone that they're not and forcing themselves to be an entrepreneur when maybe they're an intrapreneur. Mm. So I think the goal of my quiz and my book is to help people, I don't want to say stop wasting time because I really don't believe in wastes of time, but to really help people reconnect to the essence of what they really have to give in the workforce so they can stop stressing about their passions and their interests and instead realize that these things are a backdrop to their career. Like if you realize that your skill set is innovation and you're interested in wellness, understand that your 9 to 5 or whatever your hours are going to be about responsibilities that take you back to innovation most of the day. And maybe you're innovating in the wellness space, but you want to lead with that function, which is what I really try to get people into with the quiz and with my book and the skill sets.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we'll certainly make sure to link to that quiz specifically for everyone listening who's interested in taking that themselves. Ashley, let's go ahead and get practical, like really practical when it comes to specific jobs. Yeah. Let's talk about applying for jobs. A lot of folks out there won't actually apply for a job that sounds interesting to them because like they don't have enough experience. But you actually say that there is a pretty big myth about the necessity of experience. Like, yeah. Can you explain that? What do you mean by that?
I think it's important that everybody remembers that the person you're talking to on the other side of the phone or the Zoom or in person is an actual human being who is asking themselves the question, is this somebody that I want to work with? Is this somebody that matches the culture of where I staff people? Is this somebody that feels pleasant that I want to interact with on a day-to-day basis? And so really, it's almost like we are so focused on regurgitating our resume that we forget that how we communicate and how we connect authentically is pretty much more important, if not equally important, to what we're saying. So my first message is you know, applying for jobs, it's not a total waste of time. I would say applying for a job without following up, getting on LinkedIn, figuring out who the recruiter is or the hiring manager is, letting them know you submitted your resume and you're really excited to hear from them, possibly, or be considered by them. That makes it much more worth your time if you are applying for jobs. But
so that's like proactively applying for a job as opposed to just like tossing your resume their way.
Exactly. You don't want to spray and pray. That definitely just doesn't give you the results. And right now we are living in a time where the amount of applications per opening is exploding. We are in such a weird quagmire with hiring right now. We have more openings than ever, more joblessness than ever. And the reason, I think, is partially organizational. You take a look at companies who they removed the location of the job because they're accepting remote workers. Now they have, you know, applications coming from the whole world versus just their town. And as a result, the volume is so high that truly the way that you are going to get what you want and really have charge of your future is to cold network. Because, you know, a lot of people make the mistake of saying, I'm going to network with family and friends. That's cool. That's good. But when was the last time your friend's dad had the dream job that you actually want? You know, so to me, it's like, come up with a list of companies you want to be at, figure out who's hiring, like who's in a role that could actually give you your dream job, and really send personalized cold emails one after the next until you've had 20, 30, 40 conversations, which could mean 300, 400, 500 cold emails. But the thing is that life is a numbers game. And I write about my grandma, you know, I thread personal stories throughout my book, but I give a lot of career advice and tactical advice in it. And I write about my grandma, and she always used to tell me, like, if you knock on so many doors that your hands bleed, eventually somebody's always going to answer. So that has been my approach to my career and networking.
Just, yeah, knocking on as many doors as you can, like going hard after it. And I agree. I think you have to take that approach in order to land the job that you want. You got to work hard. But we have a few more questions for you. We want to talk specifically about like resumes, how you get a good resume, how do you develop that? And then network. We got some more questions about networking, because that is so important when it comes to getting that job that you want and that you're going to love. So yeah, we'll get to those questions right after this.
All right, we are back and we're talking with Ashley Stahl about ditching work that you hate and landing the job that you want. And it doesn't necessarily have to be work that you hate. You know, maybe it's just a job you don't particularly love.
Maybe you're just a little bored. Not angry, just bored.
Ashley, you know, like in your book too, you talk about being fascinating. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What does it mean to be fascinating? What does it mean to, essentially draw the attention of somebody that has the power to lead your career to higher places?
Well, one of the biggest mistakes that people make in their job hunt and in their networking efforts is not having an elevator pitch, meaning an answer to tell me about yourself. It seems painstakingly obvious to know that you should be able to talk about yourself, but it's not, because we don't often spend a lot of time being intentional about that. And according to research, I was talking to someone who was on the research team over at Stanford, and he had told me that the most memorable human emotion, you would think it would be love or connection, but it's awe, A-W-E, a sense of awe. So if you can create a sense of awe for someone, they will remember you. And what better way to do that than figuring out how you're going to answer one of the most asked questions in networking and interviews, which is tell me about yourself. And the thing about your elevator pitch is you need to train your ear to know when you're being invited into one, because it can sound like many different things and wear many different costumes. It could sound like, tell me about yourself. What got you interested in this role? Why did you move here and apply for this? Why did you leave your last job? It's all tell me about yourself. And I talk in my book about a 4-step formula to answer the question. And one of the pieces of it that I open up with is your story. And a lot of people make the mistake of kind of regurgitating their resume, which, I mean, come on now, think about the recruiter. They've heard this all day long. They could see your resume. So I like to take who you were as a kid and tie it to the career path you're choosing. So for example, I used to, as soon as I could, I got my first library card, and I spent the whole day in the library, and my mom would just bring her laptop and work there because she that's where I wanted to be. And so I used to talk about how I was a little kid, or even at the beginning of this interview, how I always talked about the news was always on when I was a kid. That would have worked at the Pentagon, walking in and they say, tell me about yourself. And I say, well, I grew up in a house where the news was always on. And from a young age, I had an opinion about politics. That takes your career and it, and this job that you're applying for. And it says, this is not just a job for me. This is part of a mission. And people want to feel connected to that. And hiring managers want to feel like you're not going to leave, because even if that's their job, nobody likes to hire all the time. It costs companies a lot of money and training. So, if, I mean, companies are offering bonuses to refer people so that they can get out of hiring. You know, this just shows how much it's important that you can be memorable. So as far as being interesting, I am just committed to living a life where I am stimulated by myself and my life, and I'm not seeking anyone else to fill that gap for me. And I'm always investing in my future self, whether it's financially or with my time or with my energy. So I would ask anyone now, what is that thing that you've always wanted to do for your future self that you're not doing? Like in my case, I want to take a poetry class online. Love poetry so much. I want to get back to learning more Arabic because I'm really rusty at it. I want to learn Spanish. There's so many things I want to invest in for my future self. And it makes me have more self-esteem because I show up for myself and I create who I am. And it also creates more value for me in the workforce in ways I could have never imagined. And so I think that that just brings color to who you are. And anytime you can bring color or raw, you're killing it.
Yeah. And it's not disingenuous, right? No. And so when it comes to talking to somebody who's interviewing you, when it comes to talking to an HR manager, you're providing a narrative for them to latch onto that makes you stand out, essentially. And again, you're not saying to lie or to not tell the truth, but you're finding a way to color in the lines for them to truly see how spectacular of a hire you could be, you know. When you have a color picture next to the same picture or something very similar that's in black and white, I mean, the color is going to be a lot more interesting.
Yeah, and when somebody looks good on paper, that doesn't always mean that they're the right fit. Kind of like you said earlier, you're talking about soft skills, and it's like, those are important too. And like, who are you as a person? Yeah. Do I want to work with you? Do I think that you're going to, you know, do you not only have the required skills, but the like ability and the fortitude and the gumption to get the job done as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I think what I really stand for is people to celebrate who they are and to be authentic, because we go to bed with ourselves at night and it's so important that we like ourselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I want to ask you too, like you mentioned before the break about getting in touch with people who are doing the work you want to be doing. And I think that's like a great suggestion, right? Not just to ask your friend's dad for a referral or to meet with him for coffee to do some networking, but to attempt to meet with the people that maybe even seem like they're going to be hard for you to get in touch with, or maybe they're not going to want to meet with you. It could result in a lot of no's or just in a lot of no responses. Like, how do you find those people though? And how do you reach out without looking like a weirdo
or a creep?
Yeah. Well, first of all, my mantra with job hunting is high intention and low attachment. So I would say, like my grandma told me, life is a numbers game. Just do the numbers and don't attach to any of the applications or emails that you put out there. And I always tell clients or people in my courses to treat the send button like the forget button, but to use the same subject line for all of those emails so that you can search in your sent folder and follow up with all of them in a timely way, like a week or two later. So that all of those emails are searchable and you could see which ones actually got a response quite easily without having to have a complicated spreadsheet. But, you know, I would say just really remembering that life is a numbers game. And if you want to create results, the cool thing about that is that you are in charge of the numbers. And so I recommend anyone, you know, just put themselves out there in a way where they say, you know what, I'm going to spend an hour a day for the next month cold emailing. And the best way to do it, I think, is going on to LinkedIn and just using the advanced search to use keywords based on your skill set. Put in your postal code if you want to stay within your city. And just start coming up with people's names that you would want to get in touch with, people who inspire you. And even more powerful is to reach out to people who are alumni of your school or your high school, And what you can do with that is put your school into the advanced search on LinkedIn. And that way, when you tell people on email that you're an alumni, they're more likely to respond to you. So that's one of the hacks to get a much better response rate.
Kind of tap into that loyalty a little bit.
Exactly.
I mean, I will say that my last break, I guess, when it came to me changing careers, it was actually via social media. But there was also a school tie there that I felt kind of gave me a little bit of an edge. I think it made that person more willing to get back to me in a positive way, and that actually ended up panning out.
Yeah.
Ashley, let's talk about resumes and cover letters. They're important in the job application process. And so what are most folks doing wrong when it comes to those?
Well, I mean, I love that you're bringing up cover letters because they're still not dead. And I think a lot of people think they are, but they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. A cold email can replace a cover letter if that's how you're networking, but job applications still require cover letters. And the thing about them is the research indicates that most recruiters do not read the cover letter, but they do acknowledge the existence of them. Uh-huh. I believe it was in the 90s percentage-wise that they want to see it there. They also use it when they're on the fence about you. The cover letter is what kicks them off of the fence. One of the mistakes people make with their cover letter is they're too salesy. They're trying to prove themselves for the role versus just showing results. So I like cover letters that have 3 to 4 bullets, you know, in them saying, here are some accomplishments that relate to your vacancy that I'm really excited about or proud of, and sharing some bullets of very high results and ROI that you've created. And if you can't quantify it, you know, do the best you can. If you can put percentages or outcomes, I think it's really important to be able to show that. As far as resumes go, it's the same thing. There's not enough results. There's too much job description. Your resume is a marketing document that is here to highlight your relevant experience. Underline the word relevant. So, you know, the fact that you had to research cat videos or whatever you had to do with your marketing job, maybe that's not relevant for the next job. So you want to look at where you're headed and write your resume from that mindset. Another thing is to look at every single bullet under every single job on your resume and make sure the first verb you're using is a power verb. Too many people are using words like assist, help, support, and they're not using words that really reflect their power and their capability. So for example, instead of the word help, help manage, maybe you could say co-managed. Instead of the word edited, you could say authored. It's just really using words that show leadership, that show initiative, because that really skews. And then, you know, the way people think about you. And another tip is to make sure your first bullet under every single job is your most powerful one, because according to heat mapping studies, recruiters are literally looking at the place you worked, the title you had, and the first bullet, and then they're moving on to the next one. Mm-hmm. So you want that first one to be really powerful.
It's kind of like reading just the headline of an article, and people think they know what they're talking about, right? It's like
exactly
the same thing the hiring managers are doing, is they're looking for that, you know, that upper level information, and if it resonates, they're going to make the call and maybe bring you in for an interview. So let's talk about what it looks like then to land the interview. That can be daunting. How do you make the splash to get a job in the interview? How do you stand out? And also, in particular, with more interviews taking place virtually, that adds another element to it, right?
Yeah. Obviously, having a professional environment and good lighting and all of that stuff creates trust. So take some time to make sure your Wi-Fi connection is good. The average house has 13 devices connected to their Wi-Fi, and that can result in a slower connection. So do what you can to make sure you're set up well virtually. Understand what the dress code is at the company and show up in that dress code on the screen. And then as far as really wowing the interviewer, it's really important. Obviously, we talked about your elevator pitch, knowing how to talk about yourself. But making sure that you have questions at the end of the interview really makes you stand out, and it shows engagement, especially when you can obviously be authentic about it. So one of my favorite questions to ask hiring managers is, if I was wildly successful in this job, you know, in the next 6 months, what are some results that you would be seeing, or what would be better in the company because of me? I love that because it gets the employer to start thinking about what they really want and associating you with those results, and people always feel more confident, because it's for employers, hiring is a bit of a transaction. It's like, these are the results we want to pay for, and this is the price we want to pay for them. Who's the right fit to do it? Who gets it? Another thing that you want to do to prepare is one of the most common questions in interviews that people also haven't prepared for, in addition to your elevator pitch, is the simple prompt of walk me through your resume. People will say, walk me through your resume. And it's really scary for people when their nervous system takes over. So what you want to do before your interview is look at every job, think about what you're interviewing for, and write in the margin of your resume so you can practice, what is an achievement, an impact, or a skill, or all three of those in each job that is really relevant for where you're headed that you can talk about as it relates to your past job and where you're headed.
I love that. It just makes it a little more practical. Ashley, and so we're going to wrap this thing up, but you know, do you have any final words of encouragement for folks? Maybe they've done all these steps or a lot of them that you've already talked about. Maybe they've interviewed, but they are not landing anything, you know, and they're still not sure what they should be doing next. What encouragement do you have for those folks?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there's always still time. Unless you're in your late 70s and getting closer to retirement time, you have years and probably decades left of your career. It's not too late to switch. It's not. Sometimes backing up does not mean backing down. And so I would say anybody who's listening, I hope that this conversation or even reading my book or listening to my work is a permission slip for them to realize that it's never too late to be who you are and to remember that who you are always wins. So you're going to have to rip the Band-Aid now and be who you are. You're going to have to rip the Band-Aid and cry later about it. But you want to face it now because, I mean, that is really the joy of life.
It's more productive. You could do it now and move on with life, or you can do it 30 years from now in counseling.
exactly.
And there's a little bit less you can do about it at that point.
Right, right. Yeah. Ashley, where can our listeners find out more about you and what you're up to?
I'm so excited that we had this conversation, and my book is available everywhere books are sold, so that's a good spot to start. It's called U-Turn, Y-O-U-Turn. Get unstuck, discover your direction, design your dream career, and it's bright yellow sunbeam that will come into your life. And then also I'm on the U-Turn podcast doing solo episodes a lot lately about career and life, and I would love to connect with people there, and of course, Instagram, at my name, Ashley Stahl.
That's great. Ashley, well, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
Holy crap. What an excellent conversation that we just had here with Ashley. She just had so much knowledge to bring, so many great tips, and such a great way of looking at pivoting in your career, you know, looking for something completely new, or even just practically speaking, landing a new job. She had so many great nuggets of wisdom, Joel, but what was one that stood out to you?
Yeah, man, there was a lot of great stuff in that conversation. I really appreciate Ashley taking the time to talk with us today. One of the things that she said in this combo was being a good consumer of something doesn't make you a good producer. Is that what you're going to say
too? You said that if I chose yours, you would change yours. So you're going to change yours?
Oh, is that what you're going to pick?
You go with that one. I'll pick something new.
All right. So yeah, I thought that was like really, really important for people to hear. Yeah. And I think that follow your passion thing is something that people get hung up on so much, especially maybe people in the younger generations, folks especially in their 30s and 40s. And I don't know if it's the same for folks in their 20s or not, but I feel like that is a message that has been taught. But just because you like something doesn't mean you're good at it, or doesn't mean that you're actually going to be fulfilled by doing that. And so I think that is a really important thing for people who are pursuing a job to think about. Fulfillment in work comes in many different ways, and it doesn't necessarily just come from loving the industry or loving the particular product that you're working on. You know, you might love Hershey's chocolate, but not enjoy working at the Hershey's chocolate plant. Like, those are two different things. You might love listening to podcasts, but not enjoy producing one, right? Like,
that's true.
There's just so many different things that should go into that decision that you're making about which direction that you're going to pursue when it comes to work. I mean, I think sometimes maybe we simplify it too much, and that's to the detriment of somebody who's out there in the workforce trying to find something that they are drawn to, that they're going to enjoy actually getting a paycheck from.
That's right. And around then, Ashley also said to just ask your friends, ask those who know you the best, when am I at my best? And if you're having a difficult time kind of figuring out what direction you should go in, that is a great place to figure out how to be yourself and how to hopefully align that with a career. So I got to find a new one here, Joel, since you stole mine, but that's totally fine. One of the other things Ashley mentioned was when she was just talking about cold emailing, kind of cold calling, getting out there, she said to make sure to be high intention but low attachment. which I think is just excellent advice, especially for somebody like me. I feel like I tend to have the opposite, where I have like, I don't want to say I have low intention. I have like low quantity, though. Like, I feel like there's a few things I'll latch onto in a very drastic sort of way, which it's like the complete opposite of Ashley, which she's basically saying, just go for it. Look at what's out there, cast your net wide and see what it is that you can pull in. It also, it kind of...
It's a numbers game is what she
said. It's a numbers game. Yeah, that's what a grandma says. but it kind of makes me think of how we talked about travel recently, which is, instead of committing to say, oh, I really want to go to Istanbul, you know, or like somewhere very specific, that would be an example of having a very high attachment to that location. And instead, hey, instead look to see where the deals are, and then maybe you can transfer your attachment from maybe this one city that you're interested in to this other city where you could save a ton of money. Yeah. I think the same thing is 100% true when it comes to looking for a new job. Apply to a lot of different jobs, see what you hear back from, and then from there you can make an informed decision. I love how what she said too about, you know, the send button when it comes to emails. I'll call it the forget button. So as you send that email, don't worry about it. Like, it shouldn't be weighing on you mentally. That was great. Some great words of wisdom for me to hear, because oftentimes I get too emotionally invested on projects or things that I am interested in. And instead, maybe I should kind of scale that back a little bit. But at the same time, don't forget it in the sense that you forget to follow up, because that's also an important part of checking in afterwards.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's going to make it easier to be less attached is the more emails you send, the harder it is going to be attached to any particular one, right? If you send 2,000 emails to people cold calling, trying to connect,
yeah,
you're like, well, they're one out of this, you know, sea of people that I'm trying to reach out to, I'm trying to connect with, I'm trying to, you know, set up a coffee date with, or just a Zoom call, or even just an email back and forth relationship to try to get some advice. So yeah, I think casting your net wide is wise advice when it comes to, yeah, pivoting and finding and building your network. So all right, Matt, let's move back to the beer that we had on this episode. Today on the show, we drank Sierra Nevada Hazy Little Thing IPA. What was your take on this beer, man?
Well, first of all, I love that this is a beer that I think pretty much anybody can find in their local grocery store.
Oh, yeah, I think Sierra Nevada distributes to all 50 states from at least my knowledge.
Yeah, oftentimes we kind of hone in on a very super obscure niche beer that one of us picked up in person at this backwoods brewery. And it might be excellent, but that doesn't mean that everyone can get their hands on it. This is, I feel like, a fantastic introduction to hazy IPAs. It's not a West Coast IPA. It's got more of that New England style, hazy style to it, which means it's just going to be a little bit sweeter. Obviously, it's hazy, not super clear. But since it's, since it's more of a macro, widely produced beer, it doesn't have a lot of those interesting hop aromas and flavors kind of going on in the background, but it is still just a really fantastic, clean. I feel like that's one of the words that stands out in my mind. It's a very clean drinking IPA. And so I think that lends kind of like a freshness to it that I really enjoy. Yeah. But yeah, what'd you think about it?
Well, I feel like that Sierra Nevada Pale Ale is kind of like one of the most classic beers out there, right? Mm-hmm. It's been in bottles for over 25 years.
Yeah,
Sierra Nevada's been around a long time. And so that's what craft beer nerds were drinking before we had like the wide variety that we have now. And I feel like this is actually kind of like a new modern classic from Sierra Nevada. It's a really good beer for what it is. Like, if you're not expecting one of those over the top IPAs, it's just like insanely hopped, right? Like, then I think you're really going to enjoy this one. I've gotten used to some of those IPAs, Matt, that are over the top. But I really like going back to this one. This one has actually kind of become a fridge staple for me lately, because I want something that's a little more relaxed, it's a little more chill, that's pretty affordable. And I feel like this IPA really fits that bill. So I'd recommend people pick it up at their grocery store. Sierra Nevada, they make good beers.
Yes, they do. And that's going to be it for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com, and we will make sure to link to some of the different resources that we mentioned during this talk here with Ashley. And if you haven't left us a review yet, we would be incredibly thankful if you went over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your shows. Leave us a solid review over there, and that helps us out. So Joel, that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.